From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, how Donald Trump received and kept the support of the Christian right. We talk with Sarah Posner, author of the new book Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. She says he may not speak the language of faith and Christian values, but he speaks the language of grievance, grievances shared by the Christian right and the alt-right. Posner is a journalist who's covered the Christian right for about 15 years. Later, Justin Chang reviews the new HBO documentary, Welcome to Chechnya. It follows a group of Russian activists and their efforts to rescue LGBTQ youth from persecution in the Chechen Republic. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by drummer Chad Taylor, co-founder of the Chicago Underground Duo. Why has the Christian right embraced Donald Trump, whose values and lifestyle seem at odds with the values espoused by Christian right leaders? That's the question that Sarah Posner tries to answer in her new book, Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. Her previous book, God's Prophets, that's prophets as in P-R-O-F-I-T-S, is about prosperity preachers. Trump's spiritual advisor, Paula White, is a prosperity preacher. Sarah Posner is a journalist who writes about the intersection of religion and politics and has covered the Christian right for about 15 years. She's currently a reporting fellow with Type Investigations, which was formerly known as the Nation Institute. Sarah Posner, welcome back to Fresh Air. Your book is subtitled Why Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. That may sound like hyperbole, but you've actually spoken to people who believe that Trump was chosen by God to lead. Who are Christian leaders who believe that?
Well, there are a number of people around Trump and his evangelical advisory board, people like Paula White, who you've mentioned in your intro. There are others outside of that particular circle who kind of filter in and out. So Paula White, Ralph Reed, who leads the Faith and Freedom Coalition, Robert Jeffress, who's a prominent megachurch pastor in Dallas. There are some other less well-known figures who help perpetuate this idea that Donald Trump has been chosen by God. Lance Wallnau, Frank Amadia, these are people who appear in the book who very much believe that Donald Trump is anointed by God, or the phraseology that some people would use is that God's hand is on him.
So for the Christian leaders who are saying that Trump has been anointed by God, what are they using to explain that, to justify that statement?
It really depends on who's speaking. It's such a common belief in the Christian right that Trump has somehow been chosen by God. The specific rationale for that varies. So some people will say, sometimes God just chooses an unlikely leader to lead a country at a very critical moment in its history. So God chose Donald Trump, who, you know, seems very unlikely to be our Christian favorite or an unlikely leader for us. But there's a reason that God chose him, and he's fulfilling America's destiny or restoring it as a Christian nation. So that might be one example of how they would talk about it. Another example is, well, in the Bible, God chose unlikely leaders, or God chose someone who was maybe not of the same religion. So maybe he's not a Christian, but just like in the Bible, God chose King Cyrus, the Persian king, to help restore the exiled Jews to Jerusalem, and he helped rebuild Jerusalem. And so the analogy there is that Trump may not be a Christian, but he's restoring Christian America.
How are Christian right leaders defending Trump's lack of leadership during the pandemic, his unwillingness to follow his own coronavirus task force advice, to wear a mask, maintain social distance, not hold large gatherings?
Well, I think it's really important to understand how the Christian right has operated in an alternative media universe throughout Trump's presidency. So they are not reading or listening to or absorbing the same kind of information about the pandemic that the rest of America is. And that's partially because they've been told by their leaders throughout Trump's presidency not to listen to the fake news media or not to listen to the deep state, because the deep state is actually trying to take down Donald Trump. So this kind of messaging has been so intense throughout his presidency, and that every questioning or investigation or exploration of his presidency by the press or by Congress or by the courts is viewed as a nefarious effort to take him down. So the distrust of the media and of science and of the government has been baked in. It's hard to convey how intense this alternative universe is, but that's why his followers are not looking at the pandemic in the same way that the rest of the country is. And it's playing out in really lethal ways, because governors who are allied with Trump are now facing a severe escalation of outbreaks of coronavirus in their states because they followed Trump's lead in states like Florida and Texas and Arizona. So this is really dangerous stuff, but it's also important to understand how intense this alternative reality is.
Do you know if the leaders of the Christian right believe that the coronavirus isn't really a threat? Do you think they believe what Trump has been saying, like 99% of people who get the virus have, you know, it's nothing, basically?
I think that there's sort of a mix. I think some of them believe that most people don't have severe symptoms, or they try to talk about the death rate not being as high among certain populations. From what I've seen, they seem to me to not be taking it very seriously from their public statements. They very much want to return to church. I mean, there have been a lot of lawsuits against governors and municipalities against the stay-at-home orders or the restrictions on large gatherings on the grounds that it violates the religious freedom of churches to not be able to gather. So even in the face of a lot of evidence that big indoor gatherings without masks and social distancing, and especially gatherings where people are talking very intensely or singing, and specifically outbreaks in churches, even in the face of all of that evidence, they still want to portray stay-at-home orders as infringing on their religious rights to gather and worship.
How was Donald Trump first embraced by the Christian right? He seems to know very little about the Bible. He's had affairs with women outside of his marriages, including with a porn star. He's constantly stating facts that aren't true. They're facts in quotes, but they're not factually accurate. He insults everyone he sees as an enemy. He demonizes Muslims, Mexicans, Black Lives Matter. He is insulting to women. I mean, these are not Christian values. So did he first embrace them because he needed more of a base? Did they first embrace him because they wanted a powerful, like a potential president, so they could get their agenda passed? Like, who embraced who?
So back in 2011, when Trump was first toying with running for president, he appeared on the Christian Broadcasting Network and basically got a lot of coaching about what he should say to appeal to an evangelical Christian audience. And I wouldn't say he did particularly well in that appearance, but he did as well as he later did in terms of catering to the Christian right's claimed priorities, like being opposed to abortion at the time, back in 2011, being opposed to same-sex marriage, although he was pretty vague about that. He did not speak the language, but it seemed pretty clear that he was getting some advice and coaching to appeal to that audience. And that was layered on his relationship with Paula White. He had met Paula White back in the mid-2000s. The story that she and others like to tell about that meeting was that Trump likes to channel surf, and he happened on her television program where she was talking about, quote, the value of vision. And he felt like that talk that she was giving really appealed to him as a businessman. He had his secretary call her up. They met. They became friends. She bought a condo in Trump Tower. And they had been friends ever since. So he really started to navigate this world of Christian television probably before he navigated the world of Christian right political activists. And when he launched his campaign finally in 2015, there were a lot of leaders in the Christian right who were extremely skeptical of him for all of the reasons that you state. But what they found was that the base was becoming enthralled with him, and they were enthralled by the very things that other people thought were not Christian: his nativism, his racist rallies, his attack on liberalism and political correctness, his attacks on the press. And so he kind of brought together these different streams of the American right into one candidate. So he brought the Christian television, televangelism in, and he brought in this racist nativist strand of the new right of the 1970s and 80s that did back then coalesce with the Christian right and bring, you know, basically bring the moral majority into Republican politics. And I think that the unifying piece of this is just a real hostility to liberal democracy, to civil rights for everyone, and hostility to the values and institutions of a liberal democracy, like a free press, an accountable government, an independent judiciary. And so he brought all of that together and he enthralled the base. And there were leaders who got on board with him early, but for the ones who followed and the leaders who signed on to support him after the base was evidently enthralled with him, they're now all in.
My impression from your book is, though, even though Trump doesn't share the values of the Christian right in terms of lifestyle and religion, the Christian right and Trump share a lot of the same grievances. So what are some of the grievances that unite them?
Trump articulates for them the idea that changes that took place largely in the second half of the 20th century, political, legal, social changes, robbed them of something, robbed them of the Christian America that they believe was God's intention for America's founding, robbed them of being able to say what the dominant form of Christianity in America is, or rob them, they believe, of their right to practice that version of Christianity.
So you say some of the Christian rights grievances date back to the 1954 Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education, which ordered the desegregation of schools. And, you know, the Christian right didn't want that. The Christian right was also worried that religious schools would lose their tax-exempt status when those schools were accused of racist policies. Do you think that part of the grievance that Trump shares with the Christian right is this fear that white America is being threatened by black people and now Muslims and Mexicans?
Yes. Yes, very much so. So the Christian right, for the evangelicals and fundamentalists who came into the national politics in the era of the moral majority, the founding story that they like to tell is that they were propelled into national politics because they were upset and outraged about Roe v. Wade, the 1973 Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion. But in fact, even by the admission of the leaders of this movement at the time, they were motivated to get involved in national politics because of federal government policy meant to desegregate or end discriminatory policies in private Christian schools after public schools were being desegregated in the wake of Brown. So in the 1960s, as public schools were desegregating, you saw a rise of what were known as segregation academies. These were private schools that were intentionally created to avoid desegregation. They were intentionally segregated. And you also saw the rise of Christian schools, which were formed for multiple reasons, including the invalidation of mandatory school prayer and Bible reading in public schools by the Supreme Court in the early 1960s. But they were definitely a response to a number of different social changes, including desegregation. And even though they weren't explicitly segregation academies, the IRS, in response to a series of court decisions, went to them and said, look, you cannot get a tax exemption and basically be subsidized by the American taxpayers by having a policy or having policies that lead to the same segregation that we're trying to end in public schools. And so the IRS came to them and said, look, you know, you should try to enroll more Black students, or you should reach out to the community to enroll more Black students. But the requirements were pretty minimal.
On a political level, what do leaders of the Christian right see in Donald Trump? What have they hoped he would deliver for them?
They hoped that he would deliver judges, which he has. And they hoped that he would deliver personnel with the freedom and flexibility to implement policy that they wanted. And he has largely done that too. So obviously judges, the Senate has confirmed about 200 federal trial and appellate court judges, plus he had the Gorsuch and Kavanaugh nominations. And in federal agencies, he has appointed political appointees who have carried out policy relating to LGBT rights, reproductive rights, religious freedom, these policies are favored by the Christian right, and they are thrilled with what he has allowed them to do. They call him the most pro-life president in history and the most pro-religious freedom president in history.
You describe the Department of Health and Human Services as ground zero for the Trump administration's efforts to scale back reproductive and LGBTQ rights and for eroding church-state separation and framing that as religious freedom for Christians. So what has happened at HHS?
One of the principal things that they did was create a conscience and religious freedom division within HHS. And there they invited members of the public to file complaints against states or healthcare providers that they believe are violating conscience protections that are written into federal law that basically allow a healthcare provider, say a nurse in a hospital, to opt out of participating in a procedure that she has a religious objection to, like an abortion or sterilization procedure. The Conscience and Religious Freedom Division is trying to expand the scope of what those conscience protections mean, to broaden the ability of these religious objectors to exercise that objection and potentially punish hospitals or even states who they believe are violating the conscience of these people.
The head of HHS, Alex Azar, is on the president's coronavirus task force. Azar has said the department has never fought more fiercely to protect life at all stages from conception until natural death. That is thanks above all to the leadership and the courage of President Trump, the most pro-life president in American history. It sounds a little ironic to hear all this talk about pro-life from Health and Human Services now that President Trump is really downplaying the deaths that have happened as a result of the coronavirus and downplaying the dangers that we all face. And he's walking around without a mask. He's not encouraging people to wear masks. He's holding, you know, these mass rallies. I wonder how that sounds to you to hear about, you know, like pro-life when so many people are dying now.
It's just mind-boggling. I mean, it really is. Because I've been listening to them for years now talk about how Trump is the most pro-life president. Not that he's done anything in particular except allow them to, you know, appoint judges and allow them to run policy at HHS. And he showed up in person for the March for Life this year, which the Christian right thought was a really big deal. But he is given a complete pass on the coronavirus. Nobody is holding him to account for his abject leadership failures, his own failure to model behavior by wearing a mask himself. He continues to call it the China virus or the Chinese virus, and focus primarily on the economy, I think, or reopening the economy. I think it shows the breadth and depth of this hero worship that has happened around Trump, where not just their goals for their policy, but their goals for what America is going to look like supersede anything, including this pandemic.
Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Sarah Posner. She covers the intersection of religion and politics. Her new book is called Unholy: Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. We'll be back after this short break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR and the following message come from DuckDuckGo. Are you tired of being tracked online? DuckDuckGo can help. They help millions of people like you take control of their personal information online. With one download, you can search and browse privately, avoiding trackers. DuckDuckGo. Privacy simplified.
Let's get back to my interview with journalist Sarah Posner, author of the new book Unholy: Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. She covers the intersection of religion and politics and has written about the Christian right for about 15 years. She's a reporting fellow at Type Investigations. What do you think is the ultimate goal of the Christian right leaders who are supporting Trump?
A very serious, more serious rollback of the separation of church and state than the Supreme Court has already undertaken, and kind of a flipping of the separation of church and state to elevate the free exercise clause over the separation clause. So to basically broaden what is perceived as religious freedom for Christians. And to have government policy and the law reflect that. So if you think about the Hobby Lobby decision, where a Christian company was permitted to opt out of providing contraception coverage in its employer health plan, bolstering government support for Christian private schools, creating huge religious exemptions so that people would not have to comply with non-discrimination laws protecting people based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Basically have a government run from the perspective of the Christian right, what they would call a biblical worldview.
So we've talked about the alliance between Donald Trump and the Christian right. Let's get to the alt-right. How does the alt-right connect in there? Does the alt-right connect to the Christian right as well as to Donald Trump?
Donald Trump speaks to both of these constituencies simultaneously when he articulates the grievances of white America. So the same grievances that he talked about in the opening of his campaign energized both the alt-right, you know, the white supremacist fringe of the American right, as well as white evangelicals who also shared these grievances about Mexicans who were criminals coming to take their jobs or change the fabric of America. And as Trump's campaign went on with his racist rallies, his attacks on Black Lives Matter protesters, his verbal attacks on Black Lives Matter protesters during campaign rallies. I mean, all of this was energizing the alt-right and white evangelicals at the same time. So Trump articulates this vision of a white America that has been somehow lost or under attack.
And so has Trump brought together the alt-right and the Christian right in a way that they hadn't been together before? Or are they already connected?
I think that they're connected by a shared hostility to liberal democracy. So there are people in the alt-right who have a lot of contempt for the Christian right and vice versa. There are a lot of people in the Christian right who would never go to a rally where people were giving Hitler salutes, which is something that happens at alt-right rallies. And there are a lot of people in the alt-right who don't really consider themselves to be particularly religious and don't really like the moralizing of the Christian right. That said, the two movements do find a common hero in Trump. And that's because they do share the same grievances and the same scapegoats for a lot of those grievances. So a lot of the conspiracy theories that you see Trump peddling in his Twitter account, you'll see articulated in Christian right and alt-right circles. So George Soros is a bogeyman in both movements. And, you know, political correctness or cultural Marxism are phrases that are used to identify basically, you know, a liberal democracy that they see as hostile to their interests.
You said that the Christian right sees Trump as the strong man they've been waiting for. What do you mean by that?
Well, they don't really like liberal democracy. And so when I say liberal democracy, I mean a democracy where there is a free press and an independent judiciary and a Congress, you know, a legislative branch that can conduct oversight of the executive branch. They really like a powerful executive who will stack the judiciary, and a powerful executive who's unafraid to attack the free press that tries to hold him to account. So it's precisely those things that they like about him, because they feel like all of those trappings of the liberal democracy are the things that are pulling the rug out from under their cultural dominance.
In addition to all the research that you've been doing historically about the Christian right and how they became aligned more recently with Trump, you've been to a lot of evangelical churches. You've been to mega churches. Can you tell us some of the things you've heard in the churches that relate to President Trump, that directly address Trump and his leadership?
Well, I think that my answer includes conferences and rallies and religious events that took place in places other than churches as well as churches. But you hear that Trump is a really great leader, that he is a historic figure, that he is a disruptor. He was the chaos candidate, and that this kind of disruption or wrecking ball is another term that I've heard used, that this is his virtue, that he is going to dismantle, you know, all this political correctness that has been bad for religious freedom. He is attacking the fake news media, which, you know, tells lies about him and his supporters. And he has come to save Christian America. So it doesn't really matter if he can't cite a Bible verse, because God has his hand on him to do these things. And sometimes God picks an unlikely leader to carry out his will.
Let me reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sarah Posner. She covers the intersection of religion and politics. Her new book is called Unholy: Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Teladoc gives those dealing with stress, anxiety, personal or family issues access to licensed therapists by phone or video. Teladoc is committed to quality, confidential therapy from the comfort of your home, available 7 days a week, matching members to therapists, counselors, and psychiatrists. Therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/freshair today to get started.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with journalist Sarah Posner, author of the new book, Unholy: Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. one of the things that the Christian right approves of is President Trump's appointment of two Supreme Court judges. I think the Christian right would see that as victories. Last month, the Supreme Court ruled that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which outlaws employment discrimination based on race, religion, national origin, and sex, that Title VII applies to gay and trans workers. Neil Gorsuch, one of Trump's appointees, wrote for the majority in that decision. Do you know what the Christian right's reaction to that has been?
They were very upset because they had vociferously argued that sex does not include sexual orientation and gender identity. However, there was a caveat in Gorsuch's opinion, which they're pinning a lot of hope on, which is that he said that we do not know yet whether religion can provide an exemption to this, because that was not an issue in the case before the court. And so he left open the possibility that a religious employer or a private employer who was religious, like Hobby Lobby, could say, well, it's against my religion to hire a gay or trans employee. And so that they're pinning a lot of hope on that one paragraph in the opinion, because obviously, like, there's kind of no going back on the main part of the opinion. But like with many other issues, they're going to work on this religious exemption approach to carving out their own distance from this particular civil rights law.
Another recent Supreme Court decision is that private schools, including religious schools, can qualify for state scholarship money. And this was a case from Montana. What's the significance of this in terms of religious groups?
It's extremely significant in terms of public school and public subsidization of private religious schools. The Christian right was very happy with this decision as compared to the Title VII decision, because it basically opens the door for the possibility of state taxpayer funding of vouchers or credits for tuition at private religious schools.
So what does that tell us about the court right now?
I think the court is very, when you look at the totality of the court's recent decisions that directly bear on religion and religious freedom and the church-state separation, I think that the court is headed in a direction that's very pleasing to the Christian right and to its decades-long effort to erode the separation of church and state and expand the meaning of religious freedom, particularly in the face of laws that protect the rights of others, like women or LGBTQ people. So I think overall, the court is very open to those kinds of arguments. I think it has shown us again and again that it is receptive to the idea that, say, requiring a baker to comply with a state non-discrimination law and bake a cake for a gay couple can be interpreted as evidence of hostility to religion. And I think that the paragraph in Gorsuch's opinion in the Title VII case only bolsters that belief, that he ruled that the plain language of the statute, sex, also includes sexual orientation and gender identity. But the big but was a big invitation to people, to litigants, to bring these claims that complying with that civil rights law could violate their religious beliefs.
Sarah Posner, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Sarah Posner is the author of the new book, Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. We recorded the interview yesterday. This morning, the Supreme Court handed down more decisions pertaining to religion. It ruled that federal employment discrimination laws don't apply to teachers who teach religion in schools run by churches. In a separate decision, the court ruled that if an employer has a religious or moral objection to birth control, it can deny its employees access to free contraception coverage in the company's health insurance plan. This is Fresh Air. In his hometown, Chicago, a couple of decades ago, jazz drummer Chad Taylor played in the Chicago Underground Duo and its trio, quartet, and orchestra offshoots. Before that, Taylor had studied music at the New School in New York. In a new trio, Taylor regroups with a couple of allies from back then. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has more.
Drummer Chad Taylor, with old school chums Neil Podgursky on piano and Brian Settles on tenor saxophone. That's from the Taylor Trio's album, The Daily Biological. I like the tough sound of this unit, partly due to a slightly odd lineup. There's no bass instrument, which throws off typical ensemble balance, but it opens up possibilities for different ways to kick the rhythm along, facilitated by the tunes the players write, like The Shepherd by Brian Settles. Whatever the mood, leader Chad Taylor moves all over the drum set, punctuating, swinging, and bringing the hi-hat funk. There have been other trios with this instrumentation, going back to the 1930s at least. Saxophonist Brian Settles' sinewy timbre, lean and ropey, puts a distinctive stamp on this tenor piano drums trio. But he doesn't play all the time, so the trio sometimes becomes a piano drums duo with its own range of moods. Chad Taylor on brushes, and Neil Podgursky on piano, sliding a left-hand bass line under his fast-running right. Taylor's trio likes to change up the textures as players enter and exit. They don't always bypass the bass register. Tenor, piano, and bass drum can each dip down there. Sometimes, the trio pursues a simple strategy at length. On the back half of Chad Taylor's Between Sound and Silence, tenor saxophone repeats a prayerful melody verbatim, while the drums slowly come to a boil. Thank you. That somber episode is a little out of character for the trio, which is apt to be more jubilant. This college reunion is a happy one. The good vibrations radiate out from the drum stool. It's a backhanded compliment to call a drummer musical. So let's say that Chad Taylor gets a lively sound from the drums and mixes a broad, big-hearted Chicago swing feel with a New Yorker's way of staying on top of the details. So his rich, ever-varied drumming tells a story, the way a good solo does, the way the whole trio does on the album The Daily Biological.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the new book, Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He reviewed The Daily Biological by the Chad Taylor Trio. After we take a short break, our film critic, Justin Chang, will review the HBO documentary, Welcome to Chechnya, about Russian activists trying to get LGBTQ youth out of Chechnya, where they're in great danger. This is Fresh Air.
Whenever you face a choice, it helps to think like an economist. And this week on Planet Money Summer School, we'll start off our course in economics with a workout for your brain, how to decide what something truly costs. Listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
These days, Chelsea Handler tries to keep her and her friends' white privilege in check.
She starts, like, really getting weepy, and I was like, well, what are you doing right now? You just said you read White Fragility. You cannot talk about reading White
Can't
Fragility
cry.
And start to cry.
Comedian Chelsea Handler on white privilege and a new book. Listen to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
The new HBO documentary, Welcome to Chechnya, follows a group of Russian activists and their efforts to rescue LGBTQ youth from persecution in the Chechen Republic. It's the latest portrait of gay and transgender activism from the director David France, following his documentaries How to Survive a Plague and The Life and Death of Marsha P. Johnson. Our film critic Justin Chang has a review.
Welcome to Chechnya is a grimly ironic title for a documentary that plays like a chilling undercover thriller. The camera work is rough and ragged. The sense of menace is palpable. The movie opens on a dark street in the southern Russian Republic of Chechnya, where a man smokes a cigarette and arranges secret meetings and transports by phone. This is David Istiev, a crisis intervention coordinator for the Russian LGBT network, and he spends his days helping gay and transgender Chechens flee a place where they are no longer safe. Homosexuality and gender nonconformity have long been frowned upon in Chechen society, but things got much worse in early 2017 when the leader of the republic, Ramzan Kadyrov, a strong man with close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin, began a violent purge of anyone suspected of being gay or transgender. It began with a drug raid when police arrested a young man and found sexually explicit images of men on his phone. He was tortured and forced to name those men, who were then also arrested, tortured, and forced to name others, setting off a horrific chain reaction. Some of the men were released, with the expectation that their own relatives would kill them, since the stigma of homosexuality runs deep in this ultra-conservative, primarily Muslim state. The journalist and filmmaker David France was first alerted to this crisis by Masha Gessen's 2017 New Yorker article and decided to make it the subject of his next film. He embedded himself with his Steve and another activist, Olga Baranova, and began filming some of the young people who turned to them for help. For security reasons, these individuals are introduced with aliases, and their circumstances and whereabouts are left deliberately vague. But as the movie tells us up front, France took an extraordinary step to protect their identities further, using sophisticated facial disguise technology. Many of the faces we see are actually the faces of people from outside Chechnya who lent their likenesses to the film. It's a bold gambit that may put off those who find it too duplicitous in the context of a documentary, but I found it remarkably effective in the way it lets these young men and women tell their stories and express a level of emotion that would have been lost if they had been filmed with blurred faces or in heavy shadows. Giving them different faces also makes a kind of poetic sense. It's a reminder that to be LGBTQ in a repressive society is to never feel comfortable in your own skin. One of these digitally altered subjects is a 21-year-old lesbian introduced as Anya, whose uncle knows her sexual orientation and demands that she sleep with him or risk being outed to her father, a powerful Chechen official. Anya decides to escape, but that isn't so easy, with the authorities soon hot on her trail. The Russian LGBT network moves her into an apartment where she must hole up for weeks on end, waiting for a travel visa that might never arrive. Similarly harrowing, but also more hopeful, is the experience of a 30-year-old Russian businessman, here called Grisha, who was detained and beaten for 12 days during a trip to Chechnya. The network helps him move to an undisclosed location in Europe with his boyfriend of 10 years. Fortunately, the brave Grisha has the support of his immediate family, who decide to move with him. As his mother notes in one poignant scene, her loyalty is to her family, not to an oppressive government. Welcome to Chechnya pays important tribute to the courage of its subjects, including activists like Estiv and Baranova, who risk their own persecution and exposure. The mere presence of France's camera might endanger their lives and their work, but it's also crucial to drawing international attention to the Chechen government's abuses. We see some of those abuses in the movie's most disturbing footage, much of it secretly filmed on cell phones and spliced into the film in brief jolts. In one video, an incarcerated man is sexually assaulted off camera by police. In another, a woman is attacked by a relative who, it's implied but not shown, proceeds to bludgeon her to death. These are ghastly images, and I'm not convinced the film needed all of them to convey the full horror of what's going on. But there's no doubting the depth of its fury and anguish on behalf of the victims and survivors we see, and the many, many more that we don't.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll hear stories of horror, heartbreak, and healing in hospital emergency rooms from ER Dr. Michelle Harper. In her new memoir, The Beauty of Breaking, she writes about treating gunshot wounds, getting punched in the face, and discovering child abuse. She says she's drawn insight from her patients as she struggled to overcome pain and trauma in her own life. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering from Charlie Kyer. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.